This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. On today's show, we will explore race in America, the backlash to what is being called, in many ways incorrectly, critical race theory, and what that means. But first, we will explore the importance of Black women intellectuals, the way in which they have framed the scholarship, the analysis, and policies to overcome white supremacy as well as male supremacy, with Ashley Farmer of the University of Texas, Austin. Civil rights, Black empowerment, and confronting structural racism and sexism have seen their profile risen in the past few years. The murder of George Floyd at the hands of police raised the profile even greater and called for a true reckoning in the United States. But these issues are not new. They are entrenched in the American experience. But analysis of their efforts and what must be done to promote social justice and equality have varied remarkably throughout the history of the nation. And in particular, Black women have advanced a unique and brilliant challenge within this discourse in promoting justice and overcoming white and male supremacy. On today's show, we will discuss the essential women who have intellectually challenged the predominant norms of racism and sexism within the nation. Our guest is Ashley Farmer, Associate Professor of African and African Diaspora Studies and History at the University of Texas at Austin. She's the author of Remaking Black Power, How Black Women Transformed an Era, and co-editor of New Perspectives on the Black Intellectual Tradition. She's also the co-editor and curator of the Black Power series with Ibram X. Kendi. Professor Farmer, thank you very much for joining us today. Your research has focused on Black women intellectuals, the way that they have raised these issues. In what ways have Black women differed from other authors, particularly Black men, at their analysis and their approach to a number of these issues?
Like you said, I'm really interested in how Black women, particularly in the 1960s and 70s, who would consider themselves Black power activists or civil rights activists, have looked around the world, thought about their oppression, and tried to come up with different analyses or ways in which could be different. And I think there's a couple of key ways that they converge with Black men on this front and a couple of key ways they diverge. First is that they're interested in the total liberation of Black people, right? That means not always necessarily just entry into, say, a body politic or entry into a particular class or entry into a set of jobs, but really talking about the liberation of Black people in all forms. That means certainly the ability to move, the ability to be housed anywhere, the ability to have different kinds of jobs, but also the ability to kind of be unbridled by the stereotypes or the confines of white supremacy. So I think that is something that they were very united in their goal in. But sometimes their approach or their scope to that was really different. So what I've discovered from my research is that many Black women, while they organized alongside Black men, found their analyses limiting in terms of sexism. And so kind of their catchphrase or their way of thinking about it was always that they said that they were content to kind of overthrow racism and capitalism, but leave patriarchy in place. And so a lot of what you see Black women that I talk about in my book doing, and these are women in the Panther Party, these are women that are part of, you know, Afrocentric groups, et cetera, is saying, if you're really talking about liberation, if you really want to talk about a whole scale upending of society and reformulating it, you can't leave Black women behind. And more specifically, that we experience racism and sexism and class inequality and sexual identification inequality differently because we're women. And so they really did push men to kind of further that critique. And sometimes they were able to do it from within organizations. And sometimes they felt they had to separate out and kind of organize, you know, outside of what we consider mixed sex organizations to make that happen.
Do you have some specific examples of ways in which this intersectionality, you know, dealing with both sexism and racism would play out in a number of these issues?
One thing would be the kinds of things that they wanted these groups to support, right? So, you know, something where somebody was engaged in an issue of police brutality was a no-brainer for most of these groups, or something where somebody was a victim of job discrimination or housing discrimination was a no-brainer. But what happened when somebody was a victim of rape? Or what happens when somebody was, you know, being attacked for the way that they looked, particularly their hair and their dress as a woman, because they weren't living up to different standards of beauty? They really wanted to make sure that they were mobilizing Black power groups around these very same issues, just as they were mobilizing around issues that were considered Black issues, but really often affected or were kind of figureheaded by Black men. Police brutality, for example, being a really big one. A great example of how this played out across the board was a woman named Joanne Little. Joanne Little was a teenager who was incarcerated through, you know, kind of the criminal justice system, as it were, and the jailer attempted to rape her, a white man, and she killed him and she fled. So this kind of got at the intersection of class politics, of women's rights, of the prison industrial complex and abolition. And it was a moment when Black power groups and civil rights groups really tried to come around her. And I think in large part because of that, she was exonerated because it was proven that this jailer had a kind of a history of this. And so, you know, that became a Black power issue in a way that you wouldn't think it would be because of women's pushing that forward.
Absolutely. Now, the subtitle is, you know, how Black women transformed an era. The era, you know, the civil rights movement is largely my understanding of what you're describing. How much, you know, has this focus really been on the civil rights movement, the role that Black women have played versus throughout history, and in particular throughout the modern history of the United States, throughout the 20th century, at least, women have played a pretty substantial role, but they really haven't been written into the history. In what ways is the civil rights era different than, say, you know, the 20s, you know, during a period where we saw activism, and, you know, during the 40s, where we saw a period of activism?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of key differences. So, I mean, you know, women are, I want to emphasize in all parts of this history, women, and particularly Black women, are really at every phase of a movement, from kind of intellectual development to rank and file organizing, to leadership, to fundraising. And that's no different in the civil rights and Black power era. But what was perhaps a little bit unique or kind of historically specific about this particular time is that they are also organizing within the context of a larger women's movement of the 1960s and 70s, sometimes what we call the women's liberation movement. And although this is largely seen as a white women's movement because it was focused on issues that often didn't think about how race mediated or kind of intersected with gender concerns, I do think that it offered the space for more women to become leaders. It offered spaces for more women to publish and talk about issues related to what they were concerned about, their gender-specific issues, even if they were considered, you know, they wouldn't consider themselves feminist or part of the women's liberation movement. So I think that's one thing. Another thing is that this was a really a great moment for the radical Black press. Now, the Black press has obviously existed since the days of slavery, but advances in printing and cost of printing and kind of circulation and globalization made it so that almost every group could print something and that it could be circulated both in the United States and globally. And if women weren't often the figureheads or the people giving the speeches at rallies, they were often writing in these publications and sometimes editing and producing these publications. So that was another way that they could really talk about and get their ideas out, particularly their ideas about what roles women should play, issues that they felt were specific, like anti-rape activism or birth control activism, we see a lot. So I think that those are two differences that help kind of spur this moment for Black women's organizing and really help them put their ideas and priorities at the forefront of the movement.
Now, when we think of the leaders of Black liberation, particularly in the civil rights era, we usually turn to the speeches, the, you know, the writings, the messages delivered by people like, you know, like Malcolm X, you know, Frantz Fanon internationally, Stokely Carmichael, and of course, Martin Luther King. First, who are some of the women that should be a part of this pantheon and asserting this is not an either or, but to be able to add, you know, to the list of voices to fully understand the ideology, the thought that goes behind the calls for reform in the civil rights movement?
I'm going to uplift two different women. The first is Ella Baker. For those who don't know, Ella Baker was a lifelong activist, probably most known for being the executive secretary of King's SCLC, and then eventually being kind of the godmother and intellectual advisor of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, was responsible for a large amount of the student sit-ins of the early 1960s, and then moved into securing voting rights as the 60s developed. So because of them, we have the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act of 64 and 65. There's not a lot about Baker besides a biography, which we can talk about when we talk about resources, but also she was a prolific writer. She'd been organizing since the 1940s and 50s during the Depression. She'd worked for the NAACP before, you know, working for King. And she also was a great speaker. So there are speeches and videos of her circulated. She has a wonderful text called Bigger Than a Hamburger, which really tries to contextualize why students were using the lunch counter as a site to kind of start or kick off the civil rights movement. And even though we kind of always read King's, you know, I Have a Dream speech, I think the Bigger Than the Hamburger speech should go alongside that as kind of a key example. And there's many more. And one of my favorite things, though, that she said is that strong people don't need strong leaders. And that was kind of her central moral philosophy. So you don't see her always out front in the same ways. But if you talk to any activist during this period of time, no one doesn't say that she was transformative in helping them think about how they should organize and what their goals were and how to be a student of this.
If I can follow up before that second, because I think that story of Ella Baker is really fascinating, because in my own understanding of the civil rights movement, there seems to be this divide between the focus on a handful of truly eloquent, you know, brilliant leaders like Martin Luther King, and that being the emphasis of the movement, as opposed to, you referenced SNCC, and how much of the civil rights movement were really individuals willing to risk their own physical security, you know, risk their health, risk being beaten by integrating lunch counters. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, that approach, that sort of big leader approach, is a bit of a masculinist approach. You know, let's find the big man, celebrate, almost create a kind of heroic vision. And while there's true greatness with those leaders, this de-emphasis on the common everyday person going out there, doing their part and risking quite a bit, you know, with that. Would you agree that's more of a masculinist approach, and the idea of a much more participatory approach tends to fall a bit more under a feminist rubric?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, it's no secret that patriarchy frames both the existence of these organizations and the ways that we write about them, right? The history of all things, but in particular, kind of Black organizing this way starts with, you know, kind of the great man, then it might go to an organization, then it might trickle down to the women, right? But really, I think what we should think about it as is more of an iceberg, where there's always work going on underneath, and then something is the catalyst that pushes it above water. But typically, women are at the top of that, but also are functioning in all of those levels as well. And I think that it's a really a mistake on the part of both historians and those of us who teach this, because as long as you're teaching about this great heroic approach, and that can include, you know, King and Malcolm, but that can also include really great women. You know, I would say somebody like Angela Davis, right, is an example of that, is that their experiences are, and their level of bravery is unmatched, but it also seems so far away from what one person can do. Right. It's either, though, you have to be King or Malcolm or Angela, right? Or you're nobody. But when we talk about it in kind of a communal approach where we see each person doing their part differently, you start to see how you can engage and kind of move the needle forward collectively, even without kind of risking it all, as they were, right? And some of those people, you know, somebody like Angela, for example, I mean, she didn't ask for any of that. She just kind of found herself in that situation, right? So we also should remember that not all of these people even, you know, anticipated that they would become kind of these martyrs or leaders that they are. Just the historical moment thrust it onto that. So I do think that that's key, both for thinking more pervasively about a movement and the individuals, but also for looking at how, you know, we can find models for ourselves of how we want to engage. And Black women offer a lot of that, kind of working among the rank and file.
Well, you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the ways in which Black women helped to frame the radicalism, the thought, the activism of the civil rights movement and throughout the movements of Black liberation with Ashley Farmer of the University of Texas, Austin. And I cut you off. You're going to give us a second name of somebody who would be, you know, a wonderful sort of recovery of the memory of some of these, you know, some of these great authors and, you know, and great speakers. So.
Yeah. So the other woman I wanted to left with is a woman named Audley Moore, sometimes called Queen Mother Moore, Queen Mother Audley Moore. And she is far less known, but equally as important. Just to give the briefest of background, she was born in 1898 and died in 1997. So basically lived a century. She began organizing in the 1920s. And her last kind of public appearance was in 1995 at the Million Man March, just to give you a scope of the level of organizing. Unlike Ella Baker, who had a college degree, Audley Moore only went through the third grade. And we would both consider them kind of what we would call organic intellectuals, meaning that they developed their political analyses and their writings from their actual experiences versus kind of formal schooling in that way. Queen Mother Moore was more on the radical side. She was interested in a form of separation for Black people and full Black political self-determination. But one of the things that she is most known for is for being the mother of the modern reparations movement. Beginning in the 1950s and throughout the 1990s, she really advocated, sometimes single-handedly and definitely on the margins, for the idea that Black people deserved repayment, and repayment could be an actual physical check, but repayment also could be symbolic, an apology, a monument, right? Policies, right? For not only all of our labor during enslavement, but also for the psychological and cultural and political effects of Jim Crow to the present, right? And she is a primary reason why, you know, today we actually have examples, particularly at the local level or at universities, of people trying to engage in ideas of reparation and repair. But she was a key kind of organizer of that. And she wrote about this. She wrote pamphlets in the 1960s talking about why reparations should happen, offering examples from international and national contexts of when reparations have been paid to wrong groups, and even offering examples of how we could do it, right? One of the things that I think is hardest for people to wrap around with reparations is it seems so enormous and it's so hard to track. How do you know, we kind of think of it as a 1-1 ratio. Did your family benefit? Should you pay? Was your family disadvantaged? Should you get money? And one of the things I think Moore really offered us is just examples to try, right? It's not cut and dry and easy, but she was often through her speeches and writings just saying, here's different ways we could do this. None of them are perfect, but at least we attempt to make amends. And so many organizers credit her with helping them understand early organizing of the 20th century, but also with understanding reparations. And I mean, organizers from, you know, lawyers like Charles Ogletree at Harvard to those grassroots organizers in Mississippi who are still organizing on behalf of this. So I think she's another great example of somebody which very little is written on, but really has kind of seeped into our intellectual consciousness in ways that we don't always understand.
I think that's a wonderful, you know, name, you know, to give all of us, and a reminder that the issue of reparations again was reinvigorated over the last, you know, few years. Ta-Nehisi Coates, you know, famous essay that has had us talking, you know, for quite a bit about the nature of reparations, that this has been an idea that's been out there for actually rather a long time. Mm-hmm. And it's not an abstract idea. It's something that we could actually start thinking about some specifics. Do you have some examples? I mean, obviously one would be, you know, sending checks, but I also know with our emphasis on structural racism, is, you know, is there a way that you could frame reparations? I know, for example, Kamala Harris had highlighted the issue about lending practices and Black home ownership, and framed it a bit as, you know, addressing structural racism, but also a reparations question, you know, opening up lines of credit for home ownership. Are there other, you know, examples, policy examples you might?
You know, Moore often suggested job programs as a way of kind of entering into the United States, and then, but also into the United States workforce, but also then giving people the opportunity to use those skills to build either within white society or separate from it. More recently, I would say that an example is Georgetown, the university. They have tried to track back those who would be the descendants of enslaves who were either sold in order to fund the university or also help kind of build the university, and offered those folks monetary and also perhaps free tuition. We've seen local level city ordinances. I think Asheville is one example where not only are they offering just an apology for the ways in which they've discriminated to Black people in the past, but also putting aside funds of money to help, you know, with Black home ownership, Black land ownership, et cetera, as a way to say, you know, we know that historically you've been marginalized for this, and that is why there's this gap here. Here's a pot of money set aside. Again, not necessarily a one-to-one, like your family as a descendant, but more as a member of this community that we know has been sidelined. Here's a way to kind of enter back into the politics and economic, you know, cycle of the community through housing, through land development, through jobs, et cetera. So those are just two examples off the top of my head. But I do think that, you know, universities writ large are now grappling more seriously with, you know, the role that either actual slaves or money from made from enslavement has created. And also then we see kind of, like we said, what we call more symbolic but equally important measures, like the taking down of buildings or monuments that are dedicated to slaveholders and changing the names of those things, and also putting up monuments to those who were enslaved. And those are all kind of the range of things we could think about in terms of reparations, because reparations is not necessarily just about payment, but it's also about repair.
No, absolutely. My own university, where my office is, was named the Von Kleinsmith Center at the University of Southern California. And for years, we had known that his research was extremely problematic. He was actually well-versed in eugenics. And so as a result of the killing of George Floyd and protests that came out of this, the university finally decided to change its name, chose an indigenous representative, Joseph Medicine Crow, to name the building after. But the irony being, we've all said, it's wonderful it's named after that. Let's hope they actually teach indigenous politics in that building. So that would be a practical issue. That was a bit of a tangent on that. Being an international relations scholar, I'm particularly fascinated in looking over your work. The emphasis on civil rights has had a tendency to focus on the United States as a bit of an exceptional case. But you have examples of a much more global approach. I think of civil rights and African decolonization and empowerment, et cetera. There's some obvious connections. How much did women contribute to the global scale and the global connections between Africa, former slaves, and other places like in Latin America, as well as here in the United States?
So I think something that's important to emphasize kind of about Black liberation struggles writ large is that they're always global in scope, because you had to be. And there's two reasons you have to be. One is that, you know, the United States as an imperialist entity is a behemoth. And so international pressure, particularly because the United States likes to present itself as kind of a champion of global democracy and justice, is a key way to kind of compel the US government to make good on their actions. And then secondly, too, if you want to organize yourself outside the confines of a nation state that really truthfully was designed and built on your exclusion, you need other models and other forms of community. And that's where the international kind of Black global community comes in. So that's always been the case. And also the fact that Black people the world over have experienced some form of slavery or colonialism or neocolonialism, right? And so there's a linked fate in that idea that Black people carry on. But specifically in the 1960s and 70s, you know, this takes on an interesting bent. Probably most importantly, because it is a moment when people are watching the decolonization of Africa in real time. Right. So if you're somebody calling out for Black power and talking about Black people organizing and governing Black people for the first time, you're really watching this happen. It really is a moment when you feel like a different world is really possible. I mean, you're really seeking connections with those people. You want to see what that's like. You want to try to build those similar connections here, et cetera. And so what we see during civil rights and Black power, particularly among Black women, is, oh, and then the final thing I'll say that is a key to this is the desegregation of transportation and the lowering of cost of transportation. So this allows for the first time, you know, Black people and particularly Black women to go abroad and travel in a really different way and see some of these places firsthand. So all of that coming together means that there is kind of this global network of Black women activists that are organizing across the world, but particularly in African, free African countries. So some of them choose to be part of the expat community. There were African nation states such as Tanzania that actively called on Black Americans to come and build, you know, the post kind of colonial state. So we see organizers go there. We also see the Black women participate in what are now these sets of international congresses and meetings. And these international congresses or meetings are all are from Black people from around the world, particularly, but not exclusively, in the liberated countries of Africa, saying, we're now facing a new moment. What is our path forward? And these Black women in particular want to make sure that their beliefs, their priorities, their positionality, their troubles are not lost. So we see people going to things like the All Africa Women's Conference in 1972. We see Black women going to the 6th Pan-African Congress in 1974, and a bevy of other informal congresses and groups. And so it really was a moment where you got to commune with Black people from all over the world in a really different way, and also with leaders of nation states in a different way. And so it was very exciting for them, and they really took advantage of that.
It seems like probably true in political progress, social justice, across the spectrum, that this, the observation of two steps forward, one step back, or two step forward, then major backlash as a result of those two steps forward. Certainly in the case of racial equality, of gender equality, civil rights, we've seen this pattern historically, and we're experiencing one right now with, you know, quite a bit of backlash. So I guess first, the backlash of the railing against critical race theory and the way in which history, you know, courses are taught. How typical is this of backlashes from progress? And how have progressives, you know, how have those who have advanced these issues generally confronted the backlash?
The punishment for Black progress is always white backlash. That is, any student of history understands that. And, we could have predicted that this would happen, you know, a couple of years after kind of the risings of kind of the George Floyd era. There's a couple of ways that progressives and radicals really think about this. One is to really just understand it in the longer arc of history, right? When you understand that this is the cycle that we're in, but that doesn't mean that the cycle doesn't both move forward, but also look different, right? It doesn't feel so new. And when it doesn't feel so new, you know that you can survive it. And you can also look to previous history, historical moments for toolkits, right? Before, you know, critical race theory was multiculturalism was the issue, right? And before there was something else. So, you know, the playbook is somewhat historically specific, but the systems of oppression remain, right? How they're manifest in that particular moment changes, but the systems of oppression remain. And there is nothing, I think, that history, particularly history of marginalized peoples, teaches you better than that. So that's, you know, everybody wants kind of a toolkit. Looking in the past, efforts are one way to do that. But there's a couple of ways also that I think are very instructive from the civil rights era. One of them is just to understand that, like, you know, folks are going to be targeted, right? And the targeting, of course, is never really about what that person is doing, for example, me teaching Black history, but more the visibility and kind of giving a face to a problem that people think that we have. So they were prepared for that by having kind of defense funds, petitions, et cetera, ready to go, kind of the stay ready so you don't have to get ready. They knew what kind of attacks were coming, and they were ready for that. The second is, you know, was the use of the Freedom School, right? We can and should continue to fight these repressive laws in our classrooms, but just because someone says that you can't teach in the classroom is not the be all end all of disseminating this information. And so, if you take back to say the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, they knew that people weren't getting basic kind of citizen classes or Black history classes in the, you know, in Mississippi. Instead of saying, let's put those in the school, they just created their own, you know, kind of extra classrooms that were not governed in the same ways to get that information across. And that really created a groundswell of educated masses that really transformed what Mississippian voting looked like. So I think that we should be ready, and I mean, many people are already doing this, but maybe a better solution is to say we should amplify those who are already doing this work and see how we can all contribute in that way as well. But, you know, we knew this was coming.
And speaking of amplification, after the realization of structural racism in the classroom, best defined by just having an awfully white syllabus. My gut reaction, you know, as an educator, as an academic, is I need to build my reading list. So in the spirit of that, who would you suggest, other than, you know, of course, we're going to suggest to all of the listeners that they read your work, which is just fabulous work. Who are some of the authors that we should be reading to expand our understanding of these issues and expand our reading list, expand our syllabus?
So I want to go back to Ella Baker. I think Barbara Ransby's biography of Ella Baker and the radical democratic freedom struggle is both a biography of Baker, but also really an organizing manual through her analysis of how Baker organized. So I think that that is, can't be beat in terms of a great place to start. If you're looking to learn more about, some of these big groups from the era, like the Black Panther Party, Robin Spencer, who works at CUNY, I think, has a wonderful book about women in Black power in the Black Panther Party in Oakland. I want to uplift, one of the things that's really cool about this period of time is that most of these folks are still around, right? And no one more so than Angela Davis, who is prolific in her own right, right? She constantly, she has a great book called Freedom is a Constant Struggle, which is just a collection of her essays that I think is good. There's Abolition Feminism Now, which recently came out, which is also great. So I think, there's no need to not listen to those who have been through some of the most repressive and difficult aspects of what we're experiencing now as for guidance to that. I think also, let's see, who else do I want to say? I think that the work of, if you're kind of moving kind of in the cultural realm, Imani Perry is especially interesting to look at. So she has wonderful biographies of folks that were active in the civil rights movement, but also cultural workers like Lorraine Hansberry. But she also got like a great book about the National Negro Anthem, Lift Every Voice, which helps you understand how the confluence of culture and civil rights comes together. And Imani is a beautiful writer. I think if you're really interested in learning about kind of the economic aspects of inequality and kind of how we got here today, I think Kianga Yamada Taylor's book, most recent book, just two, is key. And then she also, in addition to having the first book, is also has a book in which she addresses the Combahee River Collective. And the Combahee River Collective is a Black feminist collective that developed in the 1970s. And although they did not coin the term intersectionality, that came later with Kimberle Crenshaw, their manifesto or their statement was one of the first people ones to really lay out what we mean when we talk about intersecting forms of oppression. So that book not only gives the overview of the Combahee River Collective and the statement, but it's wonderful because it actually has conversations with the members of the collective, which are still around. How We Get Free is the name of that book. I'm slipping my mind for a moment. So yeah, so those are just a couple of things off the top of my head. But I mean, one of the things that is, I think, really great about being an historian in this period is that we really are in a renaissance of kind of Black women's writings and uncovering all the different ways in which Black women contributed to this history. So any one of those is a great entry point. And then, you know, from there, I'm sure you'll find many more.
And I will suggest two others. One is Remaking Black Power, How Black Women Transformed an Era, with a wonderful author, Ashley Farmer, and new perspectives on the Black intellectual tradition. And of course, the Black Power series is just, a wonderful series in, in raising these issues. So thank you for raising, raising the issues, raising our awareness of these areas. We've been talking about the empowerment of Black women, the role that Black women have played in the civil rights movement, the civil rights era, and Black empowerment, and addressing issues of white supremacy, and discussing some of the most important voices that unfortunately you may not have read, but hopefully you will very soon. Our guest has been Ashley Farmer. She is the Associate Professor of African and African Diaspora Studies and History at the University of Texas at Austin. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Special acknowledgement for our producer, Melissa Chiprin, who produced today's show.
When we return, we will explore the backlash to progressive advancements on racial equality and analysis of the U.S.'s racist past in what is being framed as critical race theory. Please stick around. Welcome back to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We originally recorded this segment on critical race theory on July 23rd, 2021. It's quite apropos for today.
The last 6 months, several states have barred the teaching of critical race theory in public schools. Critics suggest this campaign is to eliminate discussions of race in classrooms. Others suggest that critical race theory is poorly understood by its critics. On today's show, we will discuss what exactly critical race theory is and what effects these campaigns, barring its teaching, will have on honest discussions on the history, sociology, and politics in the United States. Our guests today are Utz McKnight, chair of the Department of Gender and Race Studies and professor of political science at the University of Alabama. He is the author of Race and the Politics of the Exception, Equality, Sovereignty, and American Democracy, An Everyday Practice of Race in America, Ambiguous Privilege. Laura E. Gomez is professor of law at UCLA School of Law. She has taught the Critical Race Studies program in the law school's upper year curriculum. She is the author of Inventing Latinos, A New Story of American Racism, and Manifest Destinies, The Making of the Mexican American Race. She also co-founded and has served as the first co-director of UCLA's School of Law's Critical Race Studies program. And David Livingston Smith, professor of philosophy at New England University. He is the author of Less Than Human, Why We Demean, Enslave, and Exterminate Others, and the forthcoming Making Monsters, The Uncanny Power of Dehumanization. Thank you all for joining us. Professor McKnight, let's start with you. What exactly do we mean by critical race theory?
I mean, there's no question it depends on who you're talking to. So if you mean we're all academics here, right? So in terms of how the institution is addressed, the problems and politics of race, you would have, if you went back 150 years ago, right? Deirdre Cooper Owens has written very nicely on this, the development of sort of the eugenics movement and all of this and obstetrics, right? 150 years ago, you would have had a conversation about race theory, right? So the idea of a critical race theory is let us be critical of this sort of more traditional way of talking about racial difference, right? As though those things are actually true, right? Or proper distinctions. But at the most basic level, the idea of critical race theory is the sort of constellation of beliefs that say, hey, we have to find a way to improve our society by coming up with concepts that basically address racial inequality historically in the United States, and also contemporary racial inequality. So from my point of view, this really, it really began with Derek Bell's work, Delgado, and some others. It's really a 1980s, 1990s project within jurisprudential scholarship, within the law school, with law schools around the country, as a way to talk about, let's say we have case law, you know, those are really stories. So you have like Robert Cover, Nomos and Narrative, you have these, you know, these texts, these articles that are really describing how, you know, you could do counter narratives and counter stories. Like if the law is based on, in a sense, storytelling, I know I'm being facile about it, but if it's based on storytelling, if you tell different stories, if instead you ask different people who were otherwise, let's say in 1950, would you have asked the young Black girl who has to go to the back of a store, would you sit there and interview and say, how do you feel about XYZ, right, in terms of race? It's lifting up those stories that otherwise have informed the law, you know, but kind of bringing everything to an equal basis. So right now, for me, there are three disciplines or areas of the academy in which something we call critical race theory looks very different, are sort of worked on. That's law schools, social work, and school of education. Outside of that, the idea of using critical voices or voices that would challenge existing conservative ideas of racial inequality, everybody uses them. So I hope this is, you know, an easy way to talk about it. I know the other respondents have similar ways of talking about it.
And Laura Gomez, you teach in the School of Law and certainly have helped develop critical race theory for law. I think of a response I had heard in the early stages of these conversations that said that if your child is being taught critical race theory, you should be quite proud because he or she is likely in law school. So how much is critical race theory essentially a theory of law and ultimately is in the law schools?
Right. And I endorse your you're thinking about it, the one thing that I would add to that story before I go forward is, why did that occur at that particular moment in time, right? What is the political economy? You know, what is the situation in legal education that allows that to happen? Well, it is actually a affirmative action impact. The fact that there are now enough lawyers of color, in particular African-American, but others as well, who've been lawyers for a period of time, who then are becoming law professors, right? It's only at that moment in time. And it's a great example then of the way that who is in the club, who is at the table, changes the conversation. When you look at those early critical race theory workshops, they were these, we called them summer camp. And I wasn't at the earliest one. I'm a little bit younger. I started going in the early 90s, but the earliest ones were in the 80s. And you look at those pictures and it's people of color. And they were there because they needed that community, because there was one or two of them at their school. Sadly, it's not all that different right now, but that was a real political moment. And I think we should mark that by understanding why it was people of color studying the law that then thought, really, we need a different theory. We need a different explanation of what's going on. But to get to your intro, Doug, when people are saying critical race theory today, they're not talking about what Utes was talking about, right? They're talking about some bundle of very crudely labeled critical race theory. And for people who haven't read it, I commend the New Yorker article on Chris Rufo, how a conservative activist invented the conflict over critical race theory. And in effect, what he has invented is critical race theory as a kind of epithet, as a epithet for the types of education and the types of inquiry, scholarly inquiry and K through 12 inquiry, high school inquiry, let's say, that conservatives don't like. So, you know, the advanced placement history teachers who are teaching from the 1619 project. You know, I have a friend who is teaching high school in Albuquerque, and she was saying they hired someone new, and he learned in his graduate school of education training about critical race theory, and that the teachers are really excited because he might bring some of that into the classroom, right? And it would be in the form of, you know, explanation and kind of context of law and society, right? And law and politics and how we think about US institutions. It wouldn't be at the level of, you know, the kind of debate that I am preparing in my critical race theory course for my second year law students right now, right? That is really a whole different level, which is not happening. And it's a very particular kind of training that we're doing that I think you're very right, Utes, to distinguish it from what's happening in education and in social work, which is all very legitimately critical race theory, but they've taken it and they've made something different, which is wonderful, you know, and it's not like we agree, right? Those of us who are, you know, in this field agree.
And David Livingston Smith, you write and teach quite a bit on issues of, you know, dehumanization and questions of sort of setting populations up for atrocities. And so, I mean, at some level, I imagine you're probably teaching some forms of critical race theory, even if it may not be labeled in that way. Is critical race theory, at least the way it's being discussed today, really just about teaching race in the classroom, or is it something more specific?
As we've seen, critical race theory can mean different things. There's critical race theory in a very narrow sense, and we look back to its origins in legal theory there. Then there are varying degrees of expansiveness through, that can be applied to it. In Utes's very expansive account, I certainly teach critical race theory, but certainly not in a narrow account. I've not studied that literature, and I think it's very, very important not to use terms like this improperly in the academic sphere. So I'm a philosopher who is deeply, deeply, deeply engaged with issues around race, which is very, very intimately tied to dehumanization. And I teach a course on race and racism every year In fact, it's coming up next semester, and with some, I'm entering it with some trepidation because of the episodes of people calling for professors to be fired and disciplined if they, you know, dare teach the truth. I mean, that's the kind of boring response there. What I really want to do, though, is riff off of what Lara said, which is critical race theory, the term critical race theory, as it now lives in the media and lives in the public consciousness, has very little to do with what we academics are concerned with. Now, I didn't say nothing to do with it, because the fact is, the sorts of things that we teach and we address are deeply threatening to many people, right? There is a connection, but it's a tenuous connection. Critical race theory, as it lives in the public sphere right now, is an ideological construct. It's an embodiment of what a lot of white people are terrified of and want as hard as they can not to see and not to address. And often, this is not the case here with us, but often I get a little bit frustrated with conversations with academics because, you know, they tut-tut and they say, well, this isn't really what Derek Bell wrote about or Kimberly Crenshaw. But that's kind of missing the point of the political moment.
Well, I think we can simultaneously be saying two things, right? One, you are mischaracterizing what this field is and what these claims are. And number two, actually, what we actually are about is probably deeply threatening to conservatives.
Exactly, yes.
True conservatives in this country.
And not just conservatives, by the way.
Well, that yeah, you know, I mean, I thought, and when you were talking, I was thinking not just white people.
That's true. That's true. These are unfortunately, all too handy labels, aren't they? I mean, there's a deep festering sore that I think the nation is nowhere near facing, nowhere near. And that's what's driving this campaign. You know, it's taken various forms over history. The latest form is the moral panic about critical race theory, so-called.
Hey, listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the issue of critical race theory and the recent legislation seeking to bar it with Lutz McKnight of the University of Alabama, Laura Gomez of UCLA, and David Livingston Smith of New England University. Lutz, you were going to respond.
You know, we have a choice. We can address the idea of sort of a critique looking for a problem to fasten itself to, a sort of idea that persecution works as a politics. We say, we're persecuted. Respond. And then, you know, cobbling together some sort of thing that could, in fact, claim that, oh my gosh, yes, we are persecuted like that. And then working on it. And then everybody kind of follows along with that, this sort of invented thing. Mm-hmm. We have to distinguish between that, addressing that, and deciding that, look, do we have racial inequality in this country? If we do have racial inequality in this country, we have to, and we've had, you know, as Laura very nicely points out, we now have two or even three generations of scholars within the academy. We have 50 years. I was born in 62. All of us are just starting out in this search for concepts and the idea of what democracy requires in terms of racial equality. So we can decide to address that and say, look, we need better concepts, keep working. Or we can say, wait, the persecution idea overwhelms that. We have to stop everything. Stop everything because it's a threat to, and then we wait, who is it a threat to? Like, we wait a second, we have to figure that out too. And I mean, this is, you know, it's an anti-intellectual project. It's a political project, and that's what I mean by that, rather than an academic research-based. But also, this is where the academy, there's a lot of complaints about the academy, obviously, in many different ways. But this is one of the best things about academic work, is we're actually trying to figure out concepts that then could allow us to define discrimination, could allow us to argue that it's not your personal beliefs so much as how is this reproduced, these inequalities? Mm-hmm. Right. And so if you take away the capacity of the one place where you do this research, the academy, to address these things, then you're left with kind of like, okay, let's shut everything down. And that's what this debate is. It's not so much that people are trying to do it, they're kind of forgetting that rather than pursue the persecution thing and worry about critical race theory as it's now conceptualized, in some ways, we kind of have to do our work and come up with really good concepts and not be distracted. Now, we have to address it also because it is politics, right? But let's not let it overwhelm our considerations, right, of how we could improve the society in terms of equality.
And I want to say something else on that point, Yutz, is that critical race theory from its core is not only about academic conversations, it's a political movement. And that's something that was actually very upsetting when to the early critics, the first generation of conservative critics, some liberal too, but mostly conservative critics who were writing against critical race theory in the late 80s, they were upset that it was avowedly political. You know, that we have a very particular point of view. We support greater justice for people who have been oppressed, right?
So let me riff on that just for a moment. So think about this. We've got the Civil War, right? And at the end of the Civil War, there's a group of people saying, oh my gosh, all of our privileges are going to be threatened. During the early decades of Jim Crow, we've got to guard our, like this. 1920s, 1930s, 1940s. I'm talking about the United States. The same thing. There are always people who are like, wait a second, Brown v. Board. Wait a second. Any type of progress is going to threaten our livelihood, our existence, who we are, what it is to be American. So this is a variation on that. Mm-hmm. It should be treated the same way that we treated it at that time, which is, okay, people, this is necessary for us to be America and to be democratic. That the expansion of liberties and freedoms and rights to all different communities, and no one is saying that we're not listening to you. But the fact is that if you persist in reproducing these sort of gross inequalities, we're not going to be able to have the society that we need. It's very much like the way Laura's saying, it is just a continuation of that same, it's a culture war, it's a, mm-hmm. you know, but you can go back into Jim Crow. I mean, I'm living in Alabama and, you know, Governor Wallace is standing in the schoolhouse door saying there will never be integration, right? Like this, that the stance failed was important to us as a society. Not that it succeeds. It's not a real threat, except sort of a manufactured thing as people are getting nervous.
Part of this is how much is this criticism of critical race theory? History doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. Is one of the, and you have these similar responses.
Arguably, questions about race are the big questions for the United States, certainly elsewhere too, but especially in the United States, because we're really a special case. And the horror, the cruelty, and the wish to subordinate, as it just reincarnates, it rhymes, and it reincarnates because these matters are not grappled with intellectually and politically and socially. They're just not. And this is hyperbole, but it's nonetheless significant. You know, every effort in this respect fails to go to the roots of the issues, every successful effort. And so it just keeps on simmering and bubbling and bursting out when social ecologies change in certain ways. I totally agree with the bipartite view there, that there's us as academics attempting to theorize, attempting to understand, attempting to explain. And there's the political project. And that political project is not just outside of our classrooms, right? It's inside of our classrooms too. They're interrelated, but they call for somewhat different attitudes. What sometimes concerns me is the penchant of some academics, I would say many academics, for not quite getting the political project, seeing this as just, it's a misunderstanding. It's a misunderstanding if we use that term very, very very broadly. It's, let's say it's a motivated misunderstanding. It's a misunderstanding that is motivated by the same forces that have motivated all of these events through American history, and it will take different forms. Once the critical race theory panic is over, something else will be the avatar of these issues. And as scholars, as thinkers, our job, I believe our moral responsibility as academics is to really try and find deep ways of understanding and addressing. And part of addressing is a political component. It's addressing not just with the miserable, you know, little drop of water that we can reach in our classrooms, and we never know. We don't see many people 5 years down the line, or in our writings for other academics, but in our engagement with the wider world as well. And I say as well, because all of these efforts are significant.
I want to thank you all for your incredibly thoughtful responses and some tremendous insights into this extremely important issue. Our guests today have been Utz McKnight. He's the chair of the Department of Gender and Race Studies and professor of political science at the University of Alabama. He's the author of Race and Politics of the Exception, Equality, Sovereignty, and American Democracy, and Everyday Practice of Race in America, Ambiguous Privilege. Laura E. Gomez, she is the professor of law at UCLA School of Law. She has taught in the Critical Race Studies program in the law school's upper year curriculum. She is the author of Inventing Latinos, A New Story of American Racism, and Manifest Destinies, The Making of the Mexican-American Race, which is in its second edition. She also co-founded and served as the first co-director of UCLA School of Law's Critical Race Studies program. And David Livingston Smith, professor of philosophy at New England University. He is the author of Less Than Human, Why We Demean, Enslave, and Exterminate Others, and the forthcoming, he tells me in October, Making Monsters, The Uncanny Power of Dehumanization. Thank you all very, very much.
We originally recorded this segment on critical race theory on July 23rd, 2021. It's quite apropos for today.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Sed Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org. And our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.